Right now, though, it is time to bring in Arthur Schwartz, the food maven. Arthur joins us on a Monday morning. And what do we talk about? Food. Good morning, Arthur. How are you today?
I don't ask.
Okay. I withdraw the question.
Yeah, don't ask. So I have always been intrigued by Afghanistan. And I mean, even as a boy, when I was a boy, I loved looking through atlases and learning about the countries. And I remember thinking Afghanistan is probably the most exotic place on earth. And so I have to go. I never got there. Because then I learned it was also one of the most dangerous places on earth. Even 60 years ago. Probably forever. It's interesting because it's not much of a place, you know. It's mostly mountains and desert. And years later, I guess it was the 1979, I believe, is when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan and created a little Afghani diaspora because the educated and more affluent Afghanis that could leave did. And one of them opened a restaurant on St. Mark's Place in the East Village called Cafe Kabul. And I don't remember his last name, but his first name was Shah. And I didn't usually become, in those days when I was a restaurant critic, I made a point of not becoming friends with restaurateurs or chefs who I might have to review or were reviewing or did review. But in this case, it was an exotic cuisine. I was always interested in Afghanistan. This was an exotic cuisine to me back then, 40 years ago. And it's not so much anymore. And I frequented the place and wanted to learn more about the food. So I became friendly with Shah. Anyway, one of the main dishes that we ate in those days, and I'm hoping that somebody will come to New York and make again, is a thing called Orshak. Now, left over from that period, there are Afghani restaurants in New York. Usually it's called Afghan Kebab House, and I haven't been to one in many, many years because I have really good places to go for kebabs. I didn't need any more. And Afghani kebabs are not really very much different than Uzbeki kebabs or Azerbaijani kebabs. And here in Brooklyn, we have a big Uzbeki and smaller but still a nice Azerbaijani and Tajikistani. And all the stans are represented here in Brooklyn. So I let's remember Afghanistan. It's another stan country. These are the Southwest Asian countries that were at one time part of the Soviet Union. Afghanistan never was. And the reason that nobody ever wins in Afghanistan is because the country is not a country. It's like, I don't know how many tribes. Over the weekend I read there's some amazing number of tribes in Afghanistan. And, of course, they don't get along. That's why they're called tribes. And I'm sure the food is reflected that way. So I would say that I read this over and over again, that the national dish of Afghanistan is Kabul Pulao. Now, pulao, or pilaf, as we would say in English, is a very, very common Central West Asian dish. Every place that I go to here in Brooklyn has a version of pulao. I haven't seen any Kabuli pulao, but a cab driver once led me to a place on 18th Avenue, right off of Ocean Parkway, called Tandoor House, something like that. You can't miss it. I drove by the other day, and it's got a big sidewalk, dining thing. So you can't sort of miss it as you turn onto 18th Avenue from Ocean Parkway. Anyway, he said this place has the best pulao in Brooklyn. They're Tajikistani. So he said, but you have to go no later than noon, 12:30, because that's when it comes out of the pot, and that's when you want to eat it. You don't want to come for dinner and have the reheated pulao. I understood totally. So I actually went there at 12 o'clock, 12:30 one day, and I've been there back since. And I'm laughing to myself because I brought with me a friend who I always say is anorexic. Maybe she's bulimic, but whatever it is, she doesn't eat, or if she does eat, she does something about it later. She's the skinniest person I know, and I know she's got dysmorphia. Anyway, point is, she ate everything. So if somebody, she said, "Oh, this is so delicious," and it's a rice pilaf topped with, and all the versions of pilau that I've had have had this, but there probably are some that don't have this. But on top, they put a garnish of caramelized carrots and raisins, and sometimes something else. But carrots and raisins are sort of necessary. And interesting, because grapes are one of a big crop in Afghanistan. They don't make wine. They're Muslim. They don't drink alcohol. But they got plenty of raisins. And I'm wondering, where do they get the rice? Would any of these Central Asian countries, which are mostly mountainous and mostly arid, where do they get rice from? Well, they don't import it, it ends up. In the case of Afghanistan, they get a lot of snow in those high mountains and in the central part of the country. And those mountain streams have over, I'm not going to say centuries, probably over 1,000 years, have been diverted for irrigation, maybe more than 1,000 years, have been diverted for irrigation so that they can have some limited vegetable crops and rice. You flood the field, and even if it's up on the mountainside, you know, I've actually seen this with my own eyes in other places, not in Afghanistan, but you can terrace, of course, the mountainside, and guide the water from the that's melting from the snow, because they do have very hot summers, and flood the fields to grow rice. I found an article from 2 years ago saying that Afghanistan, even 2 years ago, was 66% self-sufficient in rice. They eat a lot of rice. I don't know where the other 33% is coming from, 34%, but probably nearby, because all those countries do the same thing. They irrigate and they grow stuff. Now, it's as I said, it's limited. So, for instance, when I go to my Uzbeki restaurants, they're big on peppers and string beans, carrots, and Afghani restaurants also have, but this is in common, squash. And, of course, onions and garlic. Onions grow everywhere in the world and wild, and garlic is the same. One day, watch the Cecil B. DeMille Ten Commandments, and when Charlton Heston is a shepherd in the desert, he you see him eating wild onions and garlic, really, because it's everywhere. So the rice dish, it can be made with chicken. It can be made with meat, usually lamb. There is no beef to speak of in Afghanistan. Almost all the red meat is lamb. I guess there is some goat, white goat. I only have one little Afghani cookbook in my collection here. I thought I had more, but only one. And it was written by a refugee from the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in the late 70s. So the book was probably written by a man in I'm looking at the copyright. I think it's the early 90s, maybe. Anyway, even early 90s sounds like yesterday, but it was 30 years ago. The name of the book is Award-Winning Low-Fat Afghani Cooking. The author is Asad Garwell, and I read the introduction, so I know that he is a restaurateur in Minneapolis, and he has his restaurant, his Afghan restaurant, has gotten local awards, and he was encouraged to write this cookbook because he had a lot of customers who wanted to learn the food. Now, he did low-fat everything, meaning, you know, he cooks chicken without the skin, et cetera, et cetera. But there are a lot of interesting recipes, and I'm going to make something. I don't know what. But not the things that I'm craving. So the pulao is a project. I'm probably not going to make a pulao. I really want to have one, so I'm going to go to my Tajikistani place. And as I said, you eat what you have. So they top it with raisins, carrots, and pistachios, very common nut in that part of the world. You could use almonds, too. Dill is a big flavoring. If you go by this book, award-winning Afghani cooking, coriander seed, not so much the greens, but of course if you've got the seed, that means you have the greens and you use that too, are used in Afghani cooking. And some of the dishes, it's what I call a meat and wheat cuisine. Aside from the rice dish, which is one of the most important dishes anywhere in that part of the world, Persia as well, which is next door, I mean Iran, they make dumplings. They have wheat grows without irrigation. And the way I understand it, they grow wheat, and then they flood those fields and grow rice as an alternative crop. So they have the wheat and the rice, and with the wheat, besides making wonderful bread, here in Brooklyn you can buy Afghani bread, which is called naan, like the Indian bread, but it's different. It's more like Turkish bread, pide. In fact, I used to buy something that was called Afghani bread as a substitute for pide. It's the same thing. They also make dumplings. Now, the two that I remember most from Cafe Kabul on St. Mark's Place were Oshak and Manta. Now, Manta, which is Manti, except that you pronounce the I as a U, and Manti, Manta, are Turkish. That's definitely an influence of the Turks, who, of course, influenced that whole part of the world. And Mantu are dumplings that are filled with meat, usually, of course, lamb, and steamed. And then they can be sauced in different ways. But there's a tomato-based sauce, yogurt sauce that I used to make all the time. I mean, basically just yogurt, not Greek yogurt, you know, more liquidy yogurt, mixed with some toasted garlic and dried pinches of dried mint. It's very good on a lot of things. In fact, I have some eggplant that I'm going to cook today that I think I'm just going to be Afghani. I'm just going to do that. I'm just going to do my yogurt, garlic, salt, and mint over some fried eggplant. Very Afghani. Also, I have to say, very other cuisine. And then Oshak. Now, these are the ones, you say Afghani cuisine food to Bob, and he'll say, Oshak, I miss Oshak. Oshak are made also with, it's a dumpling, it's a pasta dough filled with leeks. Now, that's the traditional filling. In my experience here in New York, the two cooks that I know who have made me, the two cooks that I made Oshak for me used scallions, both the white and the green of the scallions. I think maybe because leeks are so expensive, I'm not sure why. But if you read Afghan recipes, they call for leeks. And it's sautéed leeks put into a very slick pasta dough, which is why I have no objection. I think actually the best thing to do is to use the store-bought Chinese wonton wrappers. You can buy those everywhere these days. And it's the same kind of slick dough that the Chinese make for wonton. And I can buy very good wonton wrappers here. So it's not just the filling that's important here, but what goes on top of the orshak. So they're filled with leeks or scallions. They have a yogurt sauce. They also may have a sauce with tomatoes and beans, if you're a vegetarian. If you're not, you can have a ground meat mixture that is put on top of the dumplings. And, oh, I don't know, orshak is a meal unto itself. I mean, you don't need any any vegetable, and you don't need any meat. It's wonderful. Another thing is they use a lot of dill. And so if you make a salad with heavy on the dill, you can say that that's Afghan. And what would be in your salad? Because they, as I said, limited number of vegetables. They do have sweet peppers, well, some hot peppers, but it's not a spicy cuisine. They have sweet peppers. They have tomatoes in the season, like we have now. You might have some kind of hearty lettuce, like romaine, and all be cut up. And you know what? They're very big on pomegranate. So I actually have seen recipes for making salad dressing with pomegranates, but more on that at another time because I'm not confident that I'm going to like these recipes. You know, it's the same thing. I'm a little skeptical of award-winning low-fat Afghani cooking. I'm surprised that I still own it. But this afternoon, another book is going to come. So I wanted it delivered on Saturday so I could study it over the weekend, but, you know, I don't know. With delivery things these days, you can't count on it.
Yeah,
eggplant is one of the main vegetables, and there is a dish that I eat at my Azerbaijani restaurant it seems to overlap with Afghani food, and it is fried eggplant that you serve cold with a dressing of, actually you add a little pomegranate syrup to your, this is what I'm going to do, to make it sweet and sour, a little pomegranate syrup to your normal kind of oil and, I would say in this case, lemon juice dressing, and then garnish with crumbled feta cheese and nuts. What kind of nuts? Depends on what you have in the house. I mean, I have peanuts in the house always. I have almonds in the house always. I'm going to probably use the almonds and break them up. They're not toasted. They're not blanched. They're just almonds, and I'm going to cut them up and chop them up coarsely and put them on top. A really good dish. And if you're vegan, I think that's a totally... No, you don't want to use the cheese if you're vegan. And there is a lot of vegetarian food in I guess you'd say Western Asia, but in fact, it's a lot of meat too. So I'm hoping that New York gets a good share of Afghani refugees. We're very welcoming to refugees here, especially if they can cook. And usually, when you get a flow of new immigrants, in this case refugee immigrants, you do get ethnic restaurants. I had a laugh the other day as I was driving by my favorite Bangladeshi restaurant, that the Bangladeshis, who used to dominate the cab industry here, are moving on, I guess. You know, second generation, even third generation, they're probably lawyers now. That my favorite Bangladeshi cab driver stop is now a Jiro place. That means the Bangladeshis have assimilated and they moved on to Greek food.
Well, you know, I was going to say, when you were talking, it sounded in the back to me like it could be an offshoot of Greek cooking.
Well, let me say the Turks, you know, influenced everybody over there. So there's a lot of Persian in Afghani cooking. There's a lot of Indian. In fact, I've even seen recipes with curry powder. Well, that's Brit. It's not really Indian, but somehow it is seeped into the Afghani cuisine. I have trouble using the word cuisine in this case, because to me, a cuisine needs a unified country. There was no, there still is no Italian cuisine 160 years after unification. It takes that long. There is a cuisine in the south of Italy because that was controlled by the Borboni and other royal families. It was as one place for 500 years. So they had time to develop a, quote, cuisine where, you know, from Naples south, the food is very more similar than it is different, although every town has different things. In Afghanistan, it's probably the same way. There is, but there's no unification there, so I don't know what's going to happen there. But here, you know, if you came from the by the way, where we just bombed, where the U.S. just bombed, in the southeast of Afghanistan, is where all the rice is, not all, but a lot of the rice is grown. You wonder if we've done something that's going to prevent Afghanis from eating. You don't want to do that. You can't have a revolution unless you have food.
You can't have anything unless you have food. Really?
Exactly. But so, you know, there may not be a, quote, cuisine there, but there are, quote, food ways. And from east side of Afghanistan to the west side of Afghanistan, I don't know enough to tell you this, but they're probably very different.
You know, what I don't understand, curry. I don't like curry. I've never liked curry. And it goes back to an old thing. Years ago, I went out on a date for a first time with somebody, and they thought I liked Indian food. I thought they liked Indian food. We got there, we ordered, neither one of us liked curry.
Let me say that, you know, curry is such a broad word that it can mean so many different dishes, and curry powder is quite different, and I'm not sure that any Indian restaurant actually uses something you would call curry powder. You know, the spice is very British. It's not at all Indian. It's their adaptation. But, you know, we eat curries from the Thai restaurant in my neighborhood, and that doesn't taste Indian at all. But they're curry, nevertheless. Maybe you should broaden your idea of curry and try something.
Maybe I don't understand enough, because I see all these cooking shows, and they use curry, and it just seems too strong of an ingredient.
Well, it's interesting you said, because in Sicily, people do use curry powder in Sicily, but you'll see a quarter of a teaspoon in a dish. I make a risotto, a Sicilian risotto with shrimp and pistachio nuts, and I use just the tiniest bit of curry powder in that. By the way, if I didn't have curry powder in my pantry, I wouldn't use it. But since it's here, I figure I might as well use it. A quarter of a teaspoon of curry. It adds a little nuance that you'd be surprised about.
Greatest risotto I ever tasted was a man who passed away who owned a restaurant in Lakeville, Cafe Julia. He would make the most unbelievable risotto, and you could ask him to make different. It was just outstanding each time. It was the best risotto I ever tasted.
And I haven't cooked for you.
That's right. Well, I like lobster.
What kind of risotto, or did he do all different kinds?
He made my favorite was lobster risotto.
Well, that's because you love lobster. But I guess he did it well, because that's a tough one to do.
Yeah.
It is, actually.
It could come out like slop. It could come out horrible, but it was always terrific. Yeah. Oh, well.
Well, all right. Well, we're moving on. I'm going to get my Afghani cookbook. There is a new one. So if you go on Amazon, there is, by the way, my little award-winning low-fat Afghani cooking is there too. It's still in print, and it's pretty cheap. But I would, you know what? By the way, the Afghan cookbooks that I found for sale on Amazon were written by Afghani restaurateurs from the last immigration wave, refugee wave from Afghanistan, and they, of course, some of them opened restaurants and. Some of them here in New York. I mean, by the way, the largest Afghani community in the U.S. is around the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area. The second largest is around Washington, D.C. That makes sense. And the third, sort of tied with Washington, D.C., is New York. And I don't know what's become of the Afghanis that I knew from the 80s. I suspect since they were all educated, they raised educated children. And I don't see any Afghani restaurants around except these kebab. Oh, but there was a period where, you know, in New York City, there are fruit vendors on the corners.
Yeah, yeah.
Most of those were Afghani. I don't know what they are today. The one on my corner is Hispanic, so I don't know where he's... I have to ask him where he comes from. A lot of Ecuadorians around in this neighborhood, so I'm suspecting maybe Ecuadorians... They've taken over the car services. Like, it used to be Bangladeshi, now it's Ecuadorian. And you always know who the new immigrant group is in New York by who the cab drivers are.
I love falafel trucks.
I don't see those around much.
Not as anymore. Much anymore. It's too bad because...
No, what I see is something you won't eat, which is the curried chicken.
That's right.
And I love it myself if it's the right truck. You know, it's for like $5, you get a big thing of rice with curried chicken and then white sauce, whatever's in that, and a red sauce, which is spicy, and it's a meal.
Now,
on the streets of New York in a styrofoam box.
I'll have to broaden my horizons and
well, but don't broaden it with that. Okay,
no.
Broaden it by going to a good Indian, if there is such a thing, restaurant, or even mediocre Thai restaurant. But I'll just to tell you that the curry, the most popular curry in Thailand, is called Massaman curry, and I had lunch with, I think I mentioned last week, with a friend who's also a listener who lives in Bangkok, and he says he never eats Massaman curry in Thailand because it's always too sweet. Well, from our Thai restaurant, it's never too sweet, and it's the mildest, so you might enjoy that. And it's not going to taste anything at all like curry that you think of.
All right. Arthur, thank you very much.
All right. Well, anyway, I'm gonna continue exploring Afghani food. Maybe I'll have to make it myself. And just one more thing, because I promised myself I would mention this. Last week I said I was playing around with my new stove's broiler.
Yep.
So I have a new technique, Marshall, for making a steak. It worked. I did it last night. It worked. I heated my cast iron skillet on top of the stove, and then put that under the broiler, put my steak on. 3 minutes on the first side, literally only, this is an inch thick steak, 2 minutes on the other side, and it was perfect. And it really, really browned, and it really, really was medium rare.
And was it nice and juicy and stuff like that?
Yeah. And by the way, it wasn't the greatest steak either. But it tasted a lot better than the other methods I've used.
All right.
Except for I still love just doing it on top of the stove in a cast iron skillet, except that it creates so much smoke around here that I don't do it frequently.
All right.
Anyway, goodbye again.
And have a good weekend. We'll speak to you next week, Arthur.
Bye-bye.
Arthur Schwartz, the food maven here on Robin Hood Radio. Of course, you can always hear him on demand, robinhoodradio.com on demand. Arthur Schwartz, the food maven. Underwriting support for Arthur Schwartz, the food maven. John Andrews Restaurant on the Hillsdale Road in South Egremont, 413-528-3467. And on the web, jarestaurant.com. Rubiner's Cheesemongers and Grocers on Main Street in Great Barrington, 413-528-0488, rubiners.com. Hillsdale Home Chef, more information, 518-325-7000, hgshomechef.com.